Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And we're back to do the spoiler edition of the Season 8, Episode 2 podcast. Aaron, you're our resident spoiler guy.
I'm sort of a spoiler phobe.
hopefully we can come together and understand where the books and the show intersect this episode.
I would like to have a little bit of fun in the beginning, and
I refuse. I don't want to have any fun
and talk about a theory that I actually wanted to talk about last week. And we ran out of time. But I think we'll have time this week, and it needs to be heard anyway, before it might be a dry pie. Mountain Leader on Reddit posted a thread, about the hot pie theory. So
you might have to recount this theory.
Says, I'm going to just read some of the stuff from this seminal work here. Many of you were a long time convinced a hot pie would be Azor Ahai or Azor Hot Pie. Sadly, I think even the most pie-hard fans of that theory have to concede that the confirmation that R plus L equals J has largely dispelled any possibility of that happening. But I would argue, who sits on the Iron Throne at the end? Who is Azor Ahai? That's all just context and world-building for the real story. The whole Ice and Fire series is actually about a hero's journey of one character from young boy on the streets of King's Landing to grown man, baker, and savior of the entire Seven Kingdoms. We've seen Hot Pie's struggles over the past few seasons, culminating with the famous never give up on the gravy line from last season. All of this is a mere prelude to events set up in Season 8. Namely, two things happen. When Tyrion mentions that they have assembled the greatest army the world has ever seen, Sansa wisely questions how they are to feed this great army. The death of the last Lord Umber means that the house is extinct and a family seat is left abandoned, waiting to be gifted to a friend of the Starks. Now, he asks, what is the Umber's seat called? The Last Hearth? And what is a hearth but a fireplace or an oven? And what can you make in a oven? Hot pies. Mm-hmm. And what can hot pies feed, Jim?
Probably an army.
The army of the living. That's you're damn right.
Yeah.
He's got like a surprisingly long post that talks about the importance of food in like siege warfare, and he cites Ser Davos, the Onion Knight, being so famed because he essentially delivered a boat full of rotten onions to Stannis' forces holding out in a siege that let them get, you know, hold out until the forces of his brother.
But I feel like that punches holes in the very foundation of this theory.
You're calling the question the gravy here? What?
Yeah, I mean, if what do you need with gravy if you have an unlimited supply of onions, is all I'm saying. And we already have the Onion Knight within the walls of Winterfell.
He's lost his onions with his fingers.
But he didn't have the onions. He can get out and smuggle them.
That's
in.
True. I guess yeah. It's true.
You have an internationally known purveyor of onions here. I don't know. I'm calling bullshit. What do you need with a hot pie guy?
Well, we got a hot pie hater here. I don't want to plagiarize this whole post, but I thought I got a real kick out of it. And if you guys want to, if it's funny stuff like the bolt-on theory and Varys is a mermaid theory stuff, if that stuff tickles your fancy, I'm going to link it in the show notes for you guys to read. Hey, before we get to the meat of the podcast, I want to talk about a little housekeeping thing that we do here. Don't forget, we are running a club sale from now until the 7th of May, 25% off all new and for the first time renewing memberships. That's right. If you're an existing club member, you can lock that 25% savings for up to 5 years by going to club.baldmove.com. And this is pertinent to Game of Thrones listeners because we are doing an instant talk segment of our Instant Take podcast this season for Game of Thrones, where club members exclusively can hear an after show where we take feedback from our fans and interact with them through the YouTube chat interface, which is pretty cool. Plus, we're also doing our Super Serious Film Fest Fantasy, so everyone gets access to the podcast and videos we do on that, but we do a live watch of the show where Jim and I actually watch the movie in question and kind of Mystery Science Theater 3000 it. It's a good time, and you can get all that at club.baldmove.com, and right now, for the next few weeks, lock in 25% savings. On Bald Move TV, which you can find the feed if you just search for Bald Move TV on your favorite podcast aggregator app, we are going to be talking about the documentaries that came out this week. The Grass is Greener on America's relationship with marijuana, the Vice Special Report on the future of work on HBO, and Beyonce's Homecoming concert, which was also on HBO. Also, today we have a Bald Movies for Avengers Endgame. It's a little movie, maybe you've heard of it. That's out and available. The spoiler-free version is available for everyone. The spoiler-filled version is available only to club members. Also on the Bald Movies feed is Super Serious Film Fest Fantasy. We just released Army of Darkness on Wednesday, so that's there if you want to talk. It's our ongoing celebration of the fantasy films that influenced and inspired things like Game of Thrones. Wrote two books about Game of Thrones and religion, godsofthrones.com. We'll be talking to Anthony a little bit later about some stuff from that. And don't forget, there's a House Snow pin, enamel pin on pin-y.com. Also, I just heard that there's another pin, a little weirwood. What'd you call it? The Stairwood?
Stairwood, yeah.
It's Bran's face on a weirwood tree. And if you don't even know that, it's just a sweet looking weirwood tree pin.
Yeah.
At pin-y.com. Okay, let's get on to the real show. Emily W. got some feedback here. When Shireen was sacrificed with Melisandre, it seemingly did nothing at all. Just a gut-wrenching, horrible moment. Immediately after, however, didn't Melisandre ride to the wall and resurrect Jon using no sacrifice? It always bothered me that Jon seems to come back to life with nothing but Melisandre's standard Red Priestess mumbo-jumbo, which has failed time and again. I think this stands up to scrutiny since the show and books typically handle resurrections in an eye-for-eye manner. When Dany's dragons are born, she sacrifices three lives, Miri, Mazdur, Drogo, and Viserys. But if Shireen's life force is stored in Melisandre's magic and used to bring him back, well, that would make a lot more sense. So, what do you think of the idea that what enabled Jon to come back was the death of Shireen?
I think we've probably, you know, questioned this over the last couple of years.
What haven't we?
Right. And of course, I'm probably going to get an entirely different answer, but I think it's possible. You know, like the Lord works in mysterious ways, and if you can establish a pattern, I think certainly it would help with future resurrections. But also, it might tell you something about the past ones.
Yeah, I mean, there's questions about like, okay, then how did like Thoros of Myr bring back Beric for the first time? Mm-hmm. Thoros killed a shit ton of people, no doubt, in the battle against Gregor's forces and all that, but like, were any of them of royal blood? He certainly didn't seem to think that was like, I found a young princeling that I tracked down to the kings of the West and I slit his throat and then I prayed. No, he just said a sincere prayer and it worked. So it's entirely possible the Lord alike can just do whatever the fuck he wants. This presumes that there is such a thing called the Lord of the Light, that it has some kind of animating will that can make choice. Like, it presupposes a whole bunch of different things that are mutually incompatible with many other types of theories. But I guess, yeah, if you think that you have to have a blood sacrifice, especially like a royal blood sacrifice, to pay for like a royal life like Jon's, then that would make sense. I guess that's also an explanation from Beric. Beric wasn't royalty, so bringing him back to life might have been
easier
with spilling common blood. What the fuck does that even mean? Yeah.
You need that. I feel like royal blood is probably like a yellow item, whereas you know, common blood is just sort of it's a blue at best.
At best. But that'd be green. Green's common, right?
Yeah, gray is pretty damn common.
Yeah,
yeah. You got that gray blood.
Or as the Harry Potter franchise, mud blood. Why? How? And who? Anthony talks a lot about the history of like this concept of royal blood and our book God of Thrones, but when I was reading, I'm just like, how did anyone ever go along with this? We get to rule because we're ordained by God, and then we always get to rule because we're ordained by God, we have special blood.
Yeah, I don't know how the commoners...
We have to keep that purity. We can't mingle with you commoners.
I can see what benefit it has for the royalty.
Sure.
For the commoners, not so much, yeah.
I don't know. If, like, 97% of the world's illiterate, I guess it's probably easy to sell a bunch of shit like that.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to Murder Bear. Episode 1, I noticed something that felt really good, much like in Episode 2. When Jon and Ned were together for the first time, Ned promised him that he would tell Jon all about his mother when they saw each other again. And then last week, Jon finds out about his mother in front of a statue of Ned Stark.
Hmm.
Then in Episode 2, I realized that Jaime knighted Brienne with Widow's Wail while she was wearing Oathkeeper. So in Winterfell, the two pieces made of Ned Stark's sword have been joined together to do one last honorable thing together inside the Stark's home.
Nice.
Pretty tasty analysis there, Murder Bear.
Mm-hmm.
Lauren M. Not sure if the Double D's meant to do this or not, but when they named Brienne a Knight of the Seven Kingdoms, I got a real Dunkin' Egg callback sensation, since the novels are called A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms, and legend has it that Brienne is descended from Sir Duncan the Tall. Well, Lauren, that was a big topic of conversation this week, and my co-author Anthony gave me a call this morning, and we recorded a couple minutes about this whole deal about the Knight of the Seven Kingdoms and what it may or may not mean, and we're going to talk about it. Joining remotely to the podcast is one Anthony LaDon. If you don't know by now, Anthony is my co-author for Gods of Thrones, Volume 1 and 2, Pilgrim's Guide to the Religions of Ice and Fire. We tried to get him on last week, but we had a big audio catastrophe, so I had to kind of just like verbally recount our conversation. This week we're going to try to do a little bit better. Welcome to the podcast, Anthony.
Thank you for having me.
A lot of people have pointed out, by now the references of this episode, including its title, A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms, to a book series, by George Martin in the Song of Ice and Fire series called the Dunkin' Egg series. It's a story about Aegon the Fifth and his unlikely rise to king, and his knight and companion and eventual Lord Commander of the Kingsguard, Sir Duncan the Tall. And since it's very lore heavy, I thought that I'd save that discussion for the lore podcast. And you know, since we're kind of the lore meisters, maybe we could save it for ourselves.
All right. So, Pod sings a song about Jenny Oldstones. Jenny Oldstones married Duncan Targaryen, who stepped away from the Iron Throne, abdicated the throne to marry Jenny.
And just to lay out the relationship, or Duncan was named after Sir Duncan the Tall.
That's right.
Aegon the Fifth's first child, and he holds Duncan in such high esteem that he named his child after him. A very un-Targaryen
name. Yeah, and
name.
I think it's cool that since the Double D's have now sort of outpaced the Song of Ice and Fire, that they don't want to be completely unhinged from Martin's world building. And so they went ahead and they're paying homage to this series of short stories, which, you know, after you've bought both volumes of Gods of Thrones and all of the series of Ice and Fire, and I don't know, maybe Homer and Shakespeare or whatever, you're going to want to read the Dunkin' Egg series. Famously, Duncan the Tall is knighted, but no one's there to witness this, right? So the story starts by this squire to Arlen Pennytree, and
who's
Arlen
kind of,
sort of
he's not exactly the dashingest, most daring knight of the Seven Kingdoms.
No, he's the hedge knight, and you know he's sort of living hand to mouth and from hedge to hedge. And there is some question about whether or not Duncan the Tall is really a knight, because no one was there to witness the ceremony. And of course, Jaime references this tradition in Westeros that any knight can make another knight, and this is repeated oftentimes in the Dunkin' Egg series. This is actually important because, unlike Duncan the Tall, who's trying to prove his honor because, you know, his status of knighthood is sort of shady at best.
Disputed.
It's disputed, right? Because it's disputed, he has to act like a knight. You know, he has to prove it to everyone and to himself that he really is a man of honor. And here we have Jaime echoing the book, and in addition to that, he does knight Brienne, but he does it in front of really important witnesses, and so there's no question about her knighthood. Her knighthood is as solid as any knight in the Seven Kingdoms. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was kind of cool that they paid homage to that series.
Yep.
Aaron, do you think that Jenny's song has some sort of predictive value on the fate of Jon Snow?
Oh, man. Let's talk about Jenny's song in general terms, first of all. So this is Jenny of Oldstones, and the story, it actually has to do with Duncan Targaryen. So Duncan Targaryen goes out in the world. He's betrothed to some Baratheon princess, like you would be. And he sees this common girl who's maybe a little off. in the Riverlands.
She is rumored to be mad.
She which means she just doesn't. She doesn't buy into the cultural conformities of her era. But she claims to have royal blood from a direct lineage of the first kings, and she talks about a bunch of nonsense. But Duncan loves this woman, and over everyone's objections, decides to abdicate his position in line of the throne, set aside his betrothal to the Baratheons, which caused a lot of problems, and marry this woman.
Mm-hmm.
By all accounts, they were very happily married. Years later, at what's been called the tragedy at Summerhall, there's something happened where King Aegon, doing some sort of ritual to try to bring dragons back into the world, burned the entire Summerhall. Was like the Targaryens, Camp David. You know, it was their summer retreat that they could get away relax. And they had all the royal family there. And somehow Aegon, with some kind of magic ceremony or experiment with wildfire or whatever you try to do to rekindle dragons, he burnt the whole place down, and almost the entire royal family survived. And the story, the song is the story.
Wait,
of
the entire royal family survived?
I'm sorry. The entire royal family got barbecued alive.
Oh, well, that's different.
So this Ginny, before we get to that part, Ginny, when she came to court, she brought her best friend with her, which was this diminutive, barely 3 foot tall woods witch, who a lot of people thought had blood of the children of the forest coursing in her veins, and she was famous for being able to give accurate prophecy. And one of the things that she prophesied was that the Azor Ahai, the prince that was promised, is going to come out of the lineage of Aerys, the Mad King Targaryen. That's one of the things that really lit a fire under Rhaegar's ass to try to intentionally create.
Yeah, he's obsessed with the prophecy, and he's trying to force it into... He's trying to act it into reality.
So this Woods Witch is a character called the Ghost of High Heart, that she hangs out in this ruined castle in the fringes of the Riverlands in the time of the Game of Thrones era.
Yeah, the Brotherhood goes and they sing this song to her, right?
Yeah, every time they want a prophecy from her, and she gives several ones. She prophesies accurately about the Red Wedding. She prophesies accurately about the Purple Wedding, and she always requests this song as payment. She just weeps to herself as the, usually it's Tom, the singer, Thomas Evans, that sings this to her, and she's it shatters every time she hears it. And a lot of people, I'm not sure if this is actual fact or this is speculation, but a lot of people think that this Ghost of High Heart is the same diminutive woman that was Ginny's friend, the Woods Witch, because they're same stature. She's very ancient and old and wizened. She's got this gift of prophecy. And this story, the song is about Ginny, Duncan Targaryen's wife, after the tragedy of Summerhall, being completely alone and bereft with everyone that she loves, and kind of slipping into madness. And, this is just a very tragic story.
Right. So what happens here is, getting back to our episode, Pod sings this song kind of out of nowhere, which sort of recalls this story about Duncan, who basically gives up the throne for the woman he loves,
and it doesn't end happily for him either. That's the other point of the song.
Right. Okay. So basically some people are speculating, does this tell us something about Jon, who may give up the Iron Throne for the sake of love and die tragically?
Yep.
So, do you think this has predictive value?
Also, trying to bring dragons back into the world, trying to bring dragons back to Wester, to the ruling class Westeros. I don't know, because it's entirely possible. There's not a lot of original songs in Game of Thrones, which is why 9 times out of 10, a squire is going to be singing The Bear and the Maiden Fair or The Rains of Castamere.
Yeah, I didn't think that the Rains of Castamere would have been an appropriate
It would have been
choice.
Hilarious if he started that up, though, right? But no.
Well, there were no Starks in the room, so I guess he could have gotten away with it.
I think that I don't know, because it's entirely possible that he's wanted a song, and there's also there's only the first not even stanza, but line or two that's in the book. It never gets finished. Right. They had to actually arrange the music themselves and come up with that whole first verse and the chorus and all that.
Right.
So I don't know. I think that if this was season four and you're asking me that question, I'm like, absolutely, this has to have meaning, because obviously they're pointing towards the thing that George is trying to do. But since we don't have the books, and since, you know, the showrunners are happy to mine stuff from the series to make it richer, but like, I don't even think that they know exactly what's going to happen. Its predictive value, I'm shaky on. It'd be cool if it ended up being. What do you think?
So, yeah, I think it adds flavor. I think it's, they know that they've outpaced the books, and and part of the reason people like this show is that it is trying to authentically adapt Martin's world, and so why not draw from these other books that are untapped? So I think that that could be what's going on here. Clearly, the title was important enough to keep secret, or at least one of the titles this season is important enough to keep secret. But the title of the show is A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms, which seems to point in the direction of the importance of this sort of era of Duncan the Tall and then Duncan the Small. And in addition to that, it is in an episode that's bookended by two knights. Right. So first, Jaime he's sort of patriated within Danny's system as a man of honor, which is something he's never been able to claim. And Brienne is the one that does this for him. And then at the end, or near the end, Jaime is able to bestow this woman of honor the status of knighthood. And he does it for everyone to see, because any knight can make a knight. And so that they are able to sort of fulfill each other in that way. But the fact that they've also thrown in Jenny's song is further fuel to this whole sort of network of connections. And it could be a feint, or it could be significant. I'm not sure.
So I'm kind of with you. I think that mostly this is a mining of the bare scraps, the oh God, we need a different song. How many seasons can we go on with these few songs that we've got? Here's one fucking line from this song that we can expand on, and we can make a thing. I think that's mostly it, but I also like the analysis from your co-author, whose name I'm totally blanking on, even though I said it a moment ago. Anthony
Laydon.
It was a long clip, I'm sorry. yeah, so I could see how it would have predictive power, but also I think you're right.
Yeah, because like that's the other thing. It's like I just think that as we go forward in time, because the source material is no longer forthcoming, that the double Ds, if anything, are kind of going further. Like they're drifting further and further off target. It's like, you know, anytime like a plane crashes in the ocean, and then they do like the drift analysis to try to get the debris, and then it's like it's a pretty contained area, but after like weeks and weeks of not having any, it's like it could be anywhere from Madagascar to fucking France. All right, what do you want me to say? And I feel like that's like the plane crashed in the ocean sometime around season five. When George stopped writing the books, and just like we're seeing the effects of these drifts. Like, yes, they sometimes find a piece of the fuselage here. They sometimes find a piece of the landing gear here in the form of these bullet points they're trying to track to. But so like the fact that this is like an infinitely cursive reference, I do think that Anthony brought a good point that like, and if you're trying to read tea leaves and seeing whether the double D's and George are still friends. It is kind of cool that they did put a lot of these Duncan egg, like the thing that Martin is still writing and is still actively doing, that they're including some of that into it. Does I think it's really nice. Hmm. I think it's kind of fitting for him. So hope that answered your question, Lauren. And again, if you appreciate Anthony and I's analysis, so you might like Gods of Thrones, and you can find both volumes at godsofthrones.com. Nicole W. So as I'm sure you've received, there's been a lot of speculation as to whether the bodies of the Starks in the crypt have come alive, will try to come alive and attack those women and children in the crypts. This leads me to pose this question. Indeed, this is a frequently pondered thing in our mailbag of late weeks. Can the White Walkers raise anyone who has died, or only those who have been killed by the White Walkers or Whites? I can't think of one moment in the show's history that showed a White being raised that wasn't killed by a White or White Walker. It could be pointed out that all the wildlings burn all of their dead, not just those killed by a White Walker or white. However, that could be a cultural thing that transcended the specifics of its origins. And here she's referring to, there's a couple scenes, I think this might have been in season 6, but it's for sure in the books, where people constantly, the wildlings, like, constantly warn about, like, you should burn your dead. If I were you, I'd be burning the dead. You should burn those dead. Even, like, people that are killed by, like, Stannis's charge and, you know, the Rangers and whatnot. Like, it's always, you should fucking burn your dead. But...
which is nice, because we're almost guaranteed not to have to witness a undead Shireen come back.
That's true. That's true. She got
or Mance.
She got charred up pretty good.
Yeah.
But I was thinking that, like, a good example that's, like, in the show, doesn't have anything to do with the books, as this hasn't happened yet or may never happen in the books. But it's Jojen's death. Recall that, like, Jojen was being, like, actively stabbed to death by a white in the gut. And his sister, like, saved him, but the child of the forest was saying, you can't, you know, he's dead already. You can die with him, or you can come to the cave with us and live. And Mira, you know, tearfully, like, Jojen was still alive and in a lot of pain, but she slit his throat to kill him. Mm. Run to the cave, but the child Leaf still incinerated his body with fire. So... if I was scoring it, I would say that Jojen did not die at the hands of the whites. I would say that he was literally killed by the hand of the living. Now, that might be splitting hairs, because if she'd waited like 60 seconds, he'd probably blood out from his like half dozen gut wounds.
Yeah.
But like, if you...
It's like asking, you know, did Oberyn kill the mountain?
Right.
Well, who knows?
Right. So I think that if you score it that way, then Leaf incinerating his body shows that a child of the forest, who would probably know more about this than anybody, thinks that he would have come back. But that's so I think that's it's not a great... I'm not giving you a straight answer. I'm saying here is a prism for which to view this question.
Yeah, the problem with even trying to speculate here is that we don't have like a control sample at all. Like, we don't... at least that I can think of, we don't have anybody who wasn't... like, the thing with the White Walkers is they kill everything around them, right?
Right.
So where are you going to get encounters with the White Walkers other than Sam, where these people aren't killed but die naturally around them?
Right.
And then don't come back or do come back to prove, you know, the theory.
Yeah. You'd almost need to see, you'd have to see some kind of big battle fought in the north that leaves a bunch of dead on the battlefield between the living. And then the living evacuate and that army gets back up sometime later. And,
but it's almost impossible to prove the negative of that,
certainly.
Right? That they can't resurrect. So,
right.
Yeah, this is a really hard theory to disprove or prove one way or another.
Let's move on to Alicia L. After watching episode 2 of this season, when Dany finds out that Jon is a rightful heir, a look on her face said to me that she would do anything to get that throne. Maybe even kill Jon.
Oh, shit.
I'm trying to recall the prophecy that she was given about her loves and fires and treasons, but I'm having a hard time. Can you discuss in your spoiler edition, maybe? Alicia, I think you're referring to a bunch of different visions that she received when she was in the House of the Undying and under the influence of the Warlocks. And these are mostly book only things. They certainly were kind of, hinted at some of this stuff in the visions she saw in the show, but in the book she received,
we see more than here.
Right. She received this particular kind of a triplet of prophecies. It says the dragon, three heads has the dragon and three fires you must light, one for life, one for death, one for love. Three mounts you must ride, one to bed and one to dread and one to love, and three treasons you will know, one for blood, one for gold, and one for love. And a pastime amongst the book readers and the people delving the lore is to kind of like speculate on what have we actually seen happen, what the significance of this, what will happen once all these three things occur. Because, you know, like three fires you must light, obviously lighting Drogo's funeral pyre for life that brought forth the three dragons, that seems pretty obvious. But like one for death, some people say that's when the House of the Undying was destroyed, and we've yet to see the fire she lights for love. Three mounts you must ride, one to bed, probably refers to the silver horse that Drogo gave her as a wedding present, and then she was bedded. One to dread, like some people say that's like the first time she rode Drogon because she was afraid. Mm-hmm. Some people think that that's come true now in the series because she mounted her dragons to fly up north to face the Night King and lost one of her children, but we still haven't seen the loved one. And the three treasons, the same thing, once for blood, once for gold, once for love. A lot of people think the treason for gold was when Jorah betrayed her for a price. And there's murky answers about the blood one and the love.
Jamie's up there is all I'm saying.
And so a lot of people, there's a couple ways to look at that. Like, what treasons will she face? But it says no, which means one of these could be a treason that she commits. And if you think that Dane's going to be a bad person, you might think that the treason for love that she commits is the one when she betrays John because she's bloodlust, or not bloodlust, power hungry, or she's obsessed
really
with Iron Throne.
For love, that's sort of against love, like, unless it's the love of the throne,
right?
The love of power,
right?
I suppose, but that's a weird way to interpret it.
Yeah, and like, are these like three separate loves? Because in the, you know, in the books, Dany, well, even in the show, she had like Drogo. I think I referred to him as Drogon earlier. She's got Drogo. She's got Dario, and then she's got Jon. But like, was she really in, like, so like a lot of stuff is unclear. Also, none of this happened in the show, so it's more of like, I would be surprised if you can't look back after the show is over and not be able to like backfill in all of these different things. Maybe one or two of these will be missing because the double D's didn't cover it. But like, I don't know how much predictive value to have because the show just looks a lot different. We've had that the wreckage has drifted.
Yeah.
But I think that's the one you're thinking about. And hopefully that analysis was interesting.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret, Hush Hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues. But then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question. Who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. The first two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV Plus, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Tom, Jaime was kicked out of the Kingsguard in Season 5 and became head of House Lannister and the Warden of the West. Why did he go straight north? Why did he not call his banners first? For the most part, in Westerosi history, when a lord calls his banners against the crown, they traditionally obey their lord. Do you have any reason that Jaime did not go to Casterly Rock and summon forth the lords of the Westerlands? My thought is that the show was trying to tell us that the Lannister army has been destroyed utterly by Dany and the Dothraki last season.
Yeah, that dragon attack was kind of the last straw for their army.
Yeah, like they might have some remnants. Some people might have escaped, but they were either destroyed or captured on the field by Dany. So they're either dead or they're now Dany's dudes instead of Jaime's dudes. That's just the whole reason why Cersei had to take a bunch of money and go get a golden company, because she was bereft of an army. But so like I'm saying, like, the so what is the Lannister army, you know? Tywin Lannister doesn't have he has his men at arms, but like that Lannister army always assumed has been kind of like all of his lords already, you know, supplying all of his men and all that kind of stuff. I could be wrong. I mean, maybe we're supposed to understand that that's kind of Lord Tywin's private army. But I always thought that that already was. It's kind of like when Rob comes forth as his army, that wasn't just the dudes in Winterfell. It was like he called all of his banners. And so I think that's already been done. And they already got destroyed. You had another point that I thought was really good, Tom. You said it's mentioned often in the books about Harrenhal and how massive it is. It's said that it could hold up to half of Westeros if needed. Other interesting things about Harrenhal is it's on the shores of the God's Eye, in the middle of which contains the only grove of weirwoods left south of the Wall, and the place where the war between the Children and the First Men were ended with a pact. It also was made of stone that was melted by dragonfire. Does that mean Harrenhal is now coated in dragonglass? This sounds like one of the most ideal locations for most of Westeros to take refuge in. I don't think I've ever read this idea before, that like all of Westeros would retreat to Harrenhal, but it sounds pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. How much do we know about the dragonglass, like, and how it's created?
Well, that's the thing. Like, if so, is dragonglass is literally obsidian, which is volcanic glass.
Yeah.
So it comes, and we also know that Old Valyria is famous for their 13. Was it the 13 fires or 13 candles? 13 furies, flames. God damn it! They had 13 volcanoes in Old Valyria, and that's like a lot of their. Like fire magic was based on, and that's probably why there's a lot of dragon activity over there, and that's why they're kind of so. Can a dragon fire melt a rock and make obsidian?
I think if the answer is yes, then Harrenhal is an awesome idea.
Yeah.
And I just, like, in my head, I'm wondering, how does that tie into Gendry's ability to sort of smelt this stuff, you know,
right?
Or just melt it down and turn it into weapons, like. Is it something that only Dragonfire could melt if Dragonfire could create it? Or is it something that, like, once it's created, you know, it's just kind of this thing that can be used however?
Yeah, it'd be hilarious if he actually ruined all the Dragonglass by melting it. Yeah. it didn't come out of Volcano, boy. It just undid all the magic.
Or maybe they're using Dragonfire in their kilns. What's the term for the super hot device that melts stone and metals and...
Forge,
sure. That sounds right. Maybe they're using Dragonfire in there.
Dragonfire Forge. Yeah. And the other thing is, like, the thing that I think is cool is that I do feel like if I use my rule of could they do with a 5 second previously on, could they reintroduce? And I know they spend a lot of time in Harrenhal. I do believe they talked about how, like, that, you know, the Harren's sons and daughters are roasted alive in the castle. I think they could show a 5 second clip that then, you know, Sam could perk up. Like, so say there's a ragtag group of survivors on the run still from the Night's King, from survivors of the Battle of Winterfell that's upcoming. I could see him being like, hey, I know it's Harrenhal was this and that, and then you have this last stand here. But the thing is the thing I don't like about it narratively is it simply kicks the can down the road. Like, I would probably be one of the voices thinking this is a little too Death Star 2-y if we had the Battle of Winterfell and then it's not conclusive, so retreat to another location and we have another battle. But this time...
Also, wouldn't you want to, in the story, just sort of cut straight to the chase? Instead of having Sam discover, oh, shit, there's this cache of dragonglass here.
Right.
Let's, you know, let's chip it out piece by piece and transport it to Winterfell. Maybe he discovers, oh, dragons actually can create dragon glass.
Sure.
And
just
let's just go to a fucking hill and melt the thing.
Right.
And like right next to Winterfell. So we've got everything we need there.
Right. It's like in Minecraft. The chumps go down into the lava right. to mine it. The smart people just take lava and dump it in the water. Is that,
right.
isn't that how you make obsidian? Yeah.
Yeah. Like you get that lava flow going.
So you gotta get in a large scale dragon manufacturing business. Mm-hmm. So I like the idea from a mechanics standpoint.
It
cool
would be
factor.
Really cool. Yeah.
It'd be very cool. But it's like, four episodes left, long episodes. But narratively, does that actually help the flow? I don't know. I just rhymed. What a time. Cody in. Why is it that when Danny is harping on about the Kingslayer, did none of the Starks bring up how the Mad King, Danny's father, brutally murdered both their grandfather and uncle in King's Landing?
I think it's because Danny already knows. Like, do you really need to bring that up?
Yeah, and they're all, everyone's kind
it's
of
just
on
gonna
their
make her defensive.
Everyone's kind of on their side against the Kingslayer, but I did wish that meeting got a little bit more contentious, like where people were hurling, because like that would just make the point to everyone in that room. If you go back one generation, maybe two, probably has a reason to hate each other. There's probably been bad blood.
Mm-hmm.
There's been wars fought and rebellions and all that. I mean,
that's fair. I think it's a bit of an oversight, but
yeah. But what are you gonna do?
Yeah.
Mackenzie W, I've heard you mention twice on the show that Qyburn invented the ballista recently, but according to canon, World of Ice and Fire / Fire and Blood, Queen Rhaenyra Targaryen died when her dragon Boy, I just realized I've never heard this word pronounced before. Meraxes. How would you pronounce that? Meraxes?
Yeah,
Meraxes.
Right.
Uh-huh. Meraxes. Suffered a scorpion bolt through the eye in Dorne during the First Dornish War, meaning they've been in existence for at least the last few hundred years.
Have we been saying that Qyburn invented it, or that these are just like... Because I think he reintroduced the idea.
I think we did, but it was like an elaborate joke.
Okay.
You know, like we were joking the fact that, like, yes, like the idea that you would invent like a really big crossbow, no one had ever thought that before, and... I, like I said, it was more of a joke than a serious thing, but if people took our japes wrongly, then
I
want to clarify
I use the same inflection when I'm serious and when I'm joking, so
yeah,
I can understand.
Called the straight man.
Mm-hmm.
Moving on to JQ. I have a weird theory that Cersei will become the Night King somehow, essentially aligning herself the Night King, merging the two inevitable battles into one. I now have a few key motives for Cersei teaming up with him. First of all, her child. Cersei offering her baby to the Night King is almost an assured win-win scenario in her eyes.
What baby?
The one that's in her belly, Jim.
That's a fake baby. It's not a real baby.
Well, this complicates the theory, if you presuppose that. We know that the Night King likes taking babies for some reason, but Cersei is probably one of the rare people who sees appeal in her child being turned to the White Walker. He or she wouldn't be weak or vulnerable. They'd be virtually immortal. We also now know the Night King intent. The Night King offers not just wiping out the world, which Cersei doesn't really give a damn about at this point, but wiping out the memory of man itself. No more heartbreak or dead children or humiliation by the High Sparrow or abandonment by those she loved. Just nothingness and cold. I think this is the deal that Cersei would take in a heartbeat, and it feels like the trajectory the character has been on since the series' beginning. I thought this was silly at first, but I don't think there's like scant plot evidence. But that does make some narrative sense, especially if you're going with
the dynasty. It certainly would be.
Yeah, like the Night King, and he's got the Night Queen, and she's like this ice cold cast iron bitch that we hate anyway, and now she's just got bright blue eyes and she's got her white. I mean, if we take the theory we talked about last week, where the Night King's going to bypass, you know, on his dragon and just go ransack King's Landing, and then the Battle of Winterfell is essentially his lieutenants, because they pointedly didn't show the Night King there, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if the Battle of Winterfell is just his lieutenants and the whites, then it would be a fucked up scene to come back to King's Landing and he's just ruling over it with Cersei at his side as a white.
Let me ask you, because let's run with this theory. What is going on with the White Walker birth rate? How do you think like that whole mechanic works?
What do you mean?
Can you have, if you were a White Walker, can you have a child? And if so, what do you need with Craster's babies?
I don't think so, no.
Okay, so the turning would have to happen a while from now?
What do you mean?
Like, Cersei couldn't be turned into a white queen or a night queen.
Oh, but okay, so,
and then have a child,
yeah,
right?
I don't think the White Walkers can have children, but if, like, a human was pregnant and turned into a White Walker?
That's what I'm asking. Like, how would that work?
I don't know.
There's literally no way to speculate.
Right.
Like, how does that. Magic... That's just my number one question.
Does magic roll with, right, kind of like the Roman Catholic understanding that a person becomes a person when the egg fertilizes
the sperm? You're the lore master. You're telling me there's no Martin book about how the mechanics of Night King and Night Queen births work?
No, there's actually...
Get on that, Martin. What are you doing? You're writing Winds of Winter thing. What is that?
A serious answer is there is this legendary... Okay, so you've heard of the Night's King, which is like this legendary 13th Lord Commander of the Night's Watch who, from the top of the tower, beheld this beautiful woman in white with piercing blue eyes, and he actually had sex with her... And procreated. Okay. So that shows that a human, if you believe old Dan's crazy theories and tales,
did he come back without being like a white himself?
I don't know. Okay. I don't think so.
Okay.
I think that, like, because it says something, but I don't know. It's all in poetic language. It's like he gave her his seed, and he also gave her his soul. Like, what does that mean? Does that mean he became a White Walker?
Right.
So, I'm
just curious.
Yeah, so one of those things is you could say, like, okay, well, a living human with a female white could actually make a White Walker. But, I mean, again, these are thousands-year-old stories that some half-crazed old woman's telling Bran to scare the shit out of him, so...
I will say I think that sounds a little too crazy for the end of this thing.
Yeah.
But... You never know.
Yeah. Let's see. Let's move on to Nick P. I couldn't help but get excited when I saw the military dispositions of the upcoming battle for Winterfell laid out, and I straight away started to think what historical battle they were going to draw on for this one. The majority of Game of Thrones battles have been based on a historical event, such as the Battle of Blackwater, which is based on the second Arab siege of Constantinople in 717 AD, Christ. The Battle of the Bastards, which was based on the Battle of Cannae in 216 BC. We know this battle is a defense of a fixed position in a newly created fortification against overwhelming odds. Number one on my list of real-world counterparts is the Battle of Rorke's Drift in 1879 as part of the Anglo-Zulu Wars. Now, do you remember, Jim, a couple years ago we did a commissioned podcast on the movie Zulu?
Uh-huh.
That is a depiction of this battle he's talking about.
Sorry, Michael Caine.
And in fact, fuck it. I'll go ahead and link our podcast review if you want to familiarize yourself with that. Why not? Get a little bit of Bald Movies feed action in there. That's a 1964 Michael Caine movie. Mm-hmm. So here's the similarities as Nick P. sees them. The enemy was an overwhelming horde of technologically inferior, quote-unquote, savages against a well-trained and disciplined fighting force. The co-commanders, Bromhead and Chard, were unable or unsure who had the better claim to the command, but nevertheless had to work together to fight the enemy. What are the events of the battle can tell us? The initial charge at the most fortified location was repelled, so a contingent went around the back and attacked from the rear. Parenthetically, why isn't Jon defending the rear of Winterfell? That's a damn good question.
Because they're coming from the north.
Yeah, like I don't know if there's... Yeah, I don't know if there's... it doesn't look like there's not but gently rolling hills to the south of Winterfell, so...
Yeah.
Maybe Jon's never heard of an enveloping maneuver.
God, I hope he has.
I mean, if you
otherwise, they are fucked.
Yeah, if you listen to Stannis, he was talking about pinchers and all that stuff. The Zulus in a previously devastating battle, the Battle of Isandlwana, took rifles and used British technology against the defending Brits, which is analogous to Dany's dragon. Previous characters turned whites, such as Hodor. However, British sharpshooters were able to get to target and eliminate the threat. Zulus break through the first line of defense and make it into the hospital wing, analogous to the crypts, and the weak and infirm inhabitants, in this case women and children, make it out through a rear window. Fighting continues.
Or it could even be analogous to like the people just outside of Winterfell. Like,
yeah.
I'm sure they brought them all inside, though.
I think so, too, from the winter town. Fighting continued until night fell, but by the morning the next day, after sustained Zulu attacks, the Zulus saw British reinforcements in the distance and retreated. Most of the battles in Game of Thrones have had an 11th hour rescue, such as Tywin in the Night of Flowers, the Battle of Blackwater, Stannis against the Wildlings, the Knights of the Vale at the Battle of the Bastards. Who will come to the rescue this time?
I mean, it's been floated that Bronn is going to take the Gold Company somehow, and head up north to help out. I honestly don't see Cersei changing her mind at all.
No.
So she's not going to, like, change of heart, miraculously come save them. And there aren't a lot of other armies in Westeros at this point.
And if we take Yara at her word, there's not enough Ironborn on the Iron Island to, like, you know, and
Euron's got them all, right?
Euron's got them, right.
And he's got the Iron Fleet, and the fleet's not going to be any good here, so.
Yeah. I will give you kudos, Nick, because I actually thought this analysis was pretty astute, and you can kind of see how, like, these beats would go just like this, right?
Mm-hmm.
We kind of shit on the idea of the Blackfish coming back out of the Riverlands as some kind of 11th hour rescue last podcast.
Yeah.
But he would be like, everyone would recognize him. We already know him as a badass. He's a very memorable character. So him coming back and just explaining, I got wind of this and brought my troops up from the Riverlands. Like,
how about, is it his nephew? How about Edmure?
Edmure, yeah.
Yeah, because we were talking about, like, how he is just kind of in the wind-ish.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was... Wasn't he last at...
He was a prisoner of the Freys, right?
But then he went to the castle where Jaime...
Yeah.
What's the name of that castle?
Because
that's where the Blackfish was supposedly killed, right?
Yeah.
Riverrun. So wasn't he there last?
I think you're right.
And taken prisoner there?
I think you're right.
So maybe he's still hanging around there, and if they have any army down there that hasn't already allied themselves with either Cersei or, you know, the banners up north, maybe.
Melisandre and the Flaming Hand, we talked about
Fiery Red Hand. Red Priestess running in.
They have all those magic-wielding priestesses. The other one that I've also kind of poo-pooed of late is Howland Reed. Mm-hmm. We know that Mira went back to go with her family. The Reeds have, like, a small but formidable, like, commando unit of frogmen infantry that use stealth and poison darts and whatnot. Like, Mira knows everything Bran knows. I could see them using, like, some kind of dragon glass blow darts shit to, like, decimate the army. Like, so those are the ones I can think of just off the top of my head.
Is there still an army in Dorne at all?
That's a great question.
Because
their leadership was decapitated, but...
Right, but wouldn't they still have troops? And could Yara potentially get their support?
Yeah, because they were working together before that happened.
Right,
happens.
And they were kind of developing a relationship before they were both captured.
Would it be crazy if Bronn somehow was commanding the Dornish forces? Because, like, I don't think Bronn had much interaction with Dorne, except for the bad Pousse.
Right.
That was his one connection.
Uh-huh.
So...
I don't think he's as likely as maybe Yara is.
Okay.
But even Yara is so unlikely.
I agree. And the other thing about Howland Reed, because people keep asking me this, is, like, he's also the other person surviving from the Tower of Joy who would absolutely know that Jon is no shit the legit son of Rhaegar Targaryen. So if Dany's still having trouble being caught up on this...
Yeah, but then it's like, the best friend of your father comes back and says,
true,
huh? Oh,
true.
Well, yeah,
who
I'll
also
believe you.
Saved our asses, by the way. I mean...
Yeah, that's fair.
All right, Eddie P., your recap podcast this week got me thinking if it's possible for the living to defeat the dead of their fallen... if their fallen replenish the Night's King's army... So I decided to create a simulator to figure out what would happen. To make a long story short, it depends on the rates at which the living and the dead kill each other. At the current numbers, the living can win if they kill the whites about 20% more efficiently than the whites kill them. At a 40% more efficiency advantage, they'd even have enough left over to take on the Golden Company in a straight-up, evenly matched fight. I've attached figures with the results and a link to a blog post with more analysis. And boy, did he ever. This is like a 5-page statistical analysis of zombie versus living killing. And then those armies rolling on to meet the Golden Company. I'm going to link it in our post so you guys can check out his numbers. I was surprised at how little, like, efficiency was required, or, you know, just, like, what little swing kind of, like, changes the matchup there.
Mm-hmm.
But, dude, you need to submit this to, like, r/theydidthemath, r/A Song of Ice and Fire, r/Game of Thrones, because, like, you could reap a karma whirlwind with this, man.
Boy. Yeah.
Original statistical analysis of Game of Thrones? Come on, now.
It is much appreciated, I'll say, because... Yeah, I was thinking, oh, it must be something like 5-1 is just sort of like my gut feeling.
Right.
Turns out it's not even near that. And it's totally not an insurmountable force.
And I had no time nor ability to critique his math, but he's got really pretty charts.
Mm-hmm. They're all rainbowy. Reds, and yellows, blues, greens.
Yeah, standard deviations, all kinds of axes labeled. So I was instantly swayed. Josh P., what if every man, woman, and child swallowed a small piece of dragon glass right before the battle begins? Wouldn't that kill them instantly if they resurrected or prevent resurrection? It's a perfect combination of dead hand and cyanide pill.
This is, yes, this is effective.
Yeah, if you just swallow a sliver now, it could be that peristalsis, or whatever the learned name for the muscular contractions that work your intestines, it might end up just slicing your guts open and killing you with sepsis, but...
Could be.
You ain't going to come back as a White Walker, that's for
How
sure.
How smooth can Gendry make? Can Gendry make a pill-shaped piece of dragon glass?
Sure, he could, but then when they... Oh, so you're saying just merely the mere touch
yeah,
of the...
I don't know. I mean, how does it work? Because, like...
Well, let me tell you how... Let me tell you, we all start... When we're fertilized eggs as a tube, that one end eventually becomes our mouth and the other end turns into our anus. And true facts, the inside of our guts are treated as the outside by our body. That's why we have all kinds of crazy bacteria living in there, et cetera, et cetera. So if you brushed a small, smooth stone of dragon glass past a White Walker or a white, would it kill them? Or does it have to, as a emailer from the last podcast said, penetrate their skin? Because if it's the latter, a smooth dragon glass pill, I would state, by the laws of biology, mm-hmm. would not kill the White Walker or whites. I keep conflating this on this podcast. But if it's just contact, then sure.
What if you replaced one of your teeth with a very sharp piece of dragon glass?
And then you will count on the White Walker to bite its tongue?
Yeah.
What if what if Arya has Gendry grind up a shit ton of dragon glass and she just uses that as like a pocket sand?
Okay. Like a blood sport kind of thing?
Yeah,
like throw it in their eyes?
The walkers inhale it.
Micro-abrasions.
Those micro-abrasions slice up their lungs and just burst into dust.
Oh, man, you could get a dragon to just sprinkle the whole field with
crop
it.
Crop dust.
Yeah, it's spraying fire out of one end, it's shitting dragon glass powder out of the other.
Yeah, yeah.
Game over.
That's how you get both ends of those tubes to work for you.
The joke isn't getting any better. Let's move on.
Matthew P., I've been wondering a lot about dragon glass and the role it plays with the living. In season 6, we've encountered Benjen Stark.
Oh, God. Oh, he's losing it.
I cracked my own damn self up. All right. It's only funny when it's not supposed to be. Matthew P., I've been wondering a lot about dragon glass and the role it plays with the living. In season 6, we encountered Benjen Stark, who is a half-man, half-white, but fights for the living. He told Bran and Mira that he was saved by the Children of the Forest by driving dragon glass into his heart while being struck down by a white with a sword of ice in his belly. I have two thoughts here. Could this technique be used by the living to fight against the White Walkers? Do you think...
Take their powers, yeah.
I guess it's my question is, like, is there any art or skill to this? Like, is there, like, some kind of intrinsic magic or technique, or you can just plunge, like, could an untrained person plunge dragon glass into a person's heart to stop this transformation?
That is a fine question. Does it have to do with, like, is simultaneity a word of
sure.
the actions?
Yeah.
Like, where you're being actively killed while you're actively killing.
Yeah. I don't know.
What? I don't know.
I mean, this question is like me saying the cure for appendicitis is to plunge stainless steel into your abdomen and to rip out the organ. That's a literally true statement.
The cure from being reanimated by appendicitis.
Right.
Right.
Right. I mean, that's a perfectly true statement, but you have to be a doctor to carry out those, you know, you have to have additional training to carry out those instructions, right?
Sure.
So, like, if to make a White Walker, you plunge obsidian in the heart, well, then anyone can make a White Walker, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if to stop it the same. So, like, I think that the first point is pretty doubtful, Matthew. I don't think that just, like, a child of the forest could, maybe Bran with his super knowledge, mm-hmm. But just a random person, I don't think so. They also bring the next point forth, which is, does Benjen come back? We didn't really see him, quote unquote, die when he saved John from the walkers, and he did say to Bran and Mira earlier that he had a role yet to play, but the magic of the wall was real and prevented him from going with them. With the wall now down, could he still come and fight for the living?
Oh, yeah, he's been spinning that lantern all the way south.
Right, and the Whites are like, we don't have to fight you. We can just go around you, right? You know that you're just one dude, and there's this whole fucking continent we can walk around, mm-hmm. and he's just still swinging and calling them pussies. Not very enlightened, that Benjen. I will say that I don't think the Bran and Mira line is very compelling, because literally he did have a role to play, which he did, which is saving John. So, mm-hmm. like, to me, that's like, what is the evidence that he has another role beyond that important role to play?
Saving John.
Yeah, because he, like, John was about to be overrun by the Wrights.
Oh, Benjen.
Benjen.
Okay,
sorry.
Yeah.
So
that was super important.
Yeah. And again, the narrative they're trying to tell there is Benjen is making a heroic last stand sacrifice. But like I said, I mean, if you want to say Benjen can't be killed and he's already kind of a white and all they could do is kind of lightly maul him, then sure, I guess he can come back.
I mean, you'd probably kill him.
I would think so. What? But he's in, how would they do that? Like set him on fire, use dragon glass on him?
Yeah, any of the things that would kill a White Walker, I would assume would kill Benjen.
Or I guess you're right. Like they could just literally dismember him. Yeah. So where like maybe he have his hands and feet could crawl around, but then what? Flop around with your jaw?
Yeah.
All right, moving on to Del. In the War Council scene, Bran explains why the Night King will be after him in particular by letting everyone in the room know that he's tried it many times before. Nobody there in that room, be it the War Council room or the writer's room, asks any follow-up questions about this. And mm-hmm. for the sake of enjoying ourselves as an audience, we should probably let that go. However, and I love these howevers, from a book lore perspective, let's take the Night King / Three-Eyed Raven struggle as a canon fact. What could have happened all those other times? It stands to reason that the Night King has not ever yet succeeded in his mission to kill the Three-Eyed Raven and bring about Eternal Night. However, the show has taught us, or at least convinced us, that the Dragonglass / Valyrian Steel plan will destroy the Night King in a pretty permanent way. So to me, this means that while the Night King has never succeeded, nor has the living ever succeeded in vanquishing him. A good question to ask Bran might be, how did they thwart the Night King's advance all those other times? Did mm-hmm. they kill him with Dragonglass, and he reappeared magically a few hundred years later anyway? Did they try to reason with him? Is it just that he's never made it this far south before? To me, the missing answers to those questions mean at least one big thing that we currently think is true can't be true. For example, Dragonglass or Valyrian Steel will not permanently kill the Night King. Or killing the Three-Eyed Raven will not permanently cut off all future Three-Eyed Ravens and will not by itself usher in an Eternal Night. Or the Night King that we saw created on the show is not the Eternal Night King, but rather just the most recent incarnation of him.
I've got one other option.
Okay.
They have been playing an eternal game of tag. And
it's human's turn to be it?
No, the Three-Eyed Raven has simply been hiding eon after eon.
Right. And it's only dumbass Bran Stark that led him right to their door, that line of Three-Eyed Ravens. That's why he doesn't want to talk about it.
Well,
he was hoping
no
one would ask questions.
Right. But we have been, you know, speculating, oh, maybe it's Bran's crossing of the wall that brought the Night King south, or enabled the Night King to cross the wall.
Yeah.
We know that the Three-Eyed Raven that he encounters was up north beyond the wall. So perhaps, you know, that game of tag has been going on for years and years and years. And they simply haven't been in a position to kill either one of them. Not that like, oh, well, Dragonglass, like they stabbed, you know, the Night King with Dragonglass and he just sort of respawns elsewhere.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think all of these have a potential to be partially true, or maybe one of them, because like there's people been already theorizing that we're going to end up with John being a Night King because someone has to fulfill the role. So that shows that this could be a cycle that keeps happening. I find it hard to believe that if the Night King kills Bran, then just the world ends. Mm-hmm. Like he didn't have to kill all the other humans, and presumably if the humans could prevail. I mean, Bran kind of like was immaculately conceived. I don't know how much the Three-Eyed Raven had to do with this, but like he just, you know, all these Stark children sprung forth with, you know, none of their parents had any of these abilities and they just got it. So like maybe mm-hmm. the old gods can just manifest these powers when they run out. Because eventually in the olden days, this was all just Children of the Forest stuff. Slowly but surely, the first men began to explore this and started getting these gifts bestowed on them. why couldn't the old gods do that again if they had to reconstitute this thing? So, and also the three-eyed raven, man, I just don't know if I agree with the show's lore, because to me, the three-eyed raven, it was always like the avatar, the spokesman for the old gods, which are manifest in all these spirits that are contained within the weirwood and all that knowledge. That he's just a way for humans to access. He's like the interface, right? You know, he's the terminal that lets you access that information. So if he dies, it's just the terminal's destroyed, but the data's still there if you could reconstruct the terminal. So I think actually there's it's potential for all three of your points to be true. And like Jim said, there's other possibilities too. Did you have anything else to add? Or
no, I guess when I'm like theorizing, I'm trying not to say, okay, well, one of these things we think currently must not be true. I'm sort of like trying to take what we think to be true and figure out how that fits within the structure of new information. And so that's why I kind of came up with the idea that, you know, they've tried to kill each other, but nobody's ever even come very close to succeeding. Because otherwise, yeah, Bran should say, look, you know, we vanquished the Night King once before with the Dragonglass dagger to his nutsack.
He's tried six times. The first time, we repelled him with Dragonglass marbles. The third time,
if he had information to volunteer, he should fucking volunteer it.
By the way, those marbles work, even though they're perfectly smooth. Like, I mean, that's the exact,
So the fact that he doesn't almost, to me, tells me that, like, there hasn't really been a situation where he would understand how to defeat the Night King.
It's like two submarines trying to find each other in the ocean, and they never made contact.
Yeah, they've had sonar pings, never been within range of torpedoes or something.
Right,
you know, somebody's run away every time, or circumstances have changed.
Yeah. Or it could, like, maybe the other thing is, like, maybe they can only fight when magical conditions are right, when you have these kind of, like, imbalances between ice and fire, and now's the latest opportunity that's presented himself. But, like, you know, in between those times when it's right, the Night King just has to twiddle his thumbs.
There's probably something in a book somewhere that
Do you think we'll get
more
satisfying answers to what the Night King is doing and try, or like how they function,
man,
or things like
the
that.
The closer we get to the end, the less I think so.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on a series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. I do kind of feel like, because this is something else that Anthony and I talked about this morning, but I cut it before time. I don't know that I buy that this is a lame motivation for the Night King.
Just straight up, I want to bring along an endless night.
Because it reminds me a lot of like Mr. Freeze from like the old Batman. Like, you know, his canonically, like he lost his wife and she was cryo-frozen and his heart turned to ice and then he became cold and you know, wanted some of his plots involve like making everyone suffer as he does. And I wonder, like, you know, if the Night King is just a mortal human who's had everything stripped from him and he's now in this icy body and he has to do the Children of the Forest's bidding and he can't feel anymore. He can't like have love. Like I feel like it's a fairly straightforward, like, well, if I'm cursed this way, all should be kind of thing. Like I feel like those motivations are understandable. They're not laudable, but like, you know, just wanting this burning need for revenge or everyone to suffer the way he's been forced to suffer. I kind of think that's borderline deep or at least compelling.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's compelling,
but, I think they need, if they're going to make that land, they need to like the Night King needs to speak they need to have like some kind of like, he needs to articulate that somehow. It can't just be like, well, this is what the fan on, you know, the Reddit boards came up with.
You're gonna watch him like from a distance see Danny and John kiss, and he's just gonna fume. He's gonna be so mad. You see it on his face.
He's gonna pull off his mask. It's gonna be Arnold Schwarzenegger underneath there,
right?
And he's gonna give speeches. Give speeches about what killed the dinosaurs and whatnot. Okay. Let's move on to Leon T. I'm wondering whether the Night King is manipulating Bran and controlling which visions he sees. Could the Night King be leading Bran down certain rabbit holes to get him to misdirect the forces of the living and position Bran where he can get access to him? We may have already seen an example of this when the Night King put his mark on Bran.
And Bran is an especially inexperienced three-eyed raven.
Yeah.
Let's not forget that.
I mean, that's my big critique for this theory is that, so you're saying this is essentially Luke on Dagobah receiving visions of his friends being tortured, but actually these were manipulations by Vader and Emperor to get him to Cloud City so they could turn him. Okay.
Sure.
One to one. That's exactly what we've seen. But like, wasn't that exactly what happened? Like the three-eyed Raven said, you're not ready. You can't do this. You shouldn't dwell on these topics. And Bran sneaks off and does it anyway. And the Night King marks him. So like, we already had the Cloud City,
and you see how that turns out,
right?
Right.
So if Bran
wins that, he sort of, you know, well, he doesn't win it. Maybe John can turn the Night King to his side.
Now that I'm thinking about it, though, because like the
conclusion, maybe Benjen's the Vader.
Benjen's the Vader.
Yeah.
Oof. I think that if you carry that theme further, so like if we had our Dagobah Cloud City moment, the resolution of that plot line is that Luke, instead of being lured to Vader by deceit, voluntarily confronts him with with his righteous cause and mind and his faith and being able to turn his father. I wonder if there'll be analogous to like Bran realizes he has to face the Night King and they have to personally like do
or
battle.
This will just continue forever, right?
Yeah, like if he keeps running
this game of tag they've been playing,
that's
not working for the realm.
It's starting to come together.
Could be.
It's like get these spoiler points registered with the spoiler authority so we can get those valuable spoiler points. Vicky E, why is everyone all in anticipation of what will happen to the dead in the crypt beneath Winterfell, while the crypt beneath the Red Keep contains dead dragons, including Balerion the Black Dread?
Fair.
We'll know him by the hole in his skull from the scorpion test. If the Night King is in or out to King's Landing, it isn't to take Cersei. She's no threat and easily disposed of. He's after some dragons.
I think it's because the fandom, myself included, can barely contain our excitement about the Battle of Winterfell.
Yeah.
That's about to take place. And we got to get beyond that before we can uncloud our heads and think clearly about whatever battle's going to take place in King's Landing.
I do have a little bit of bucket of cold water to the throw on this dragon fire.
Oh, shit.
Therefore making obsidian. It's just a dragon skull. Mm-hmm. Like, there's not the entire fossilized or preserved remains of the dragon skeletons. At least there's no evidence. It's always the skulls. The skulls, the skulls. So, like,
yeah,
what the fuck can the Night King do with a reanimated dragon skull? I mean, some of those whites were awful bony. I actually went back and watched a Jojen execution scene, and the dude that killed him
was basically a skeleton.
Mm-hmm. Like Jason and Argonaut style. But even still, it had a fucking body.
Right. It had
An arm it could swing and stab with.
Of mobility, you know? It was...
Oh, dude, what if it's...
dragons just breathe dragon fire out of the skulls? Like, they're booby traps now?
I'm back around. The Night King affixes these skulls to massive wagons, and they're like flame-throwing tanks, man. Like, straight out of Red Alert. And those things were nasty, if I recall.
I love it.
So...
I love it. Actually, what if Qyburn is actually able to invent a true original weapon? So he sees that he goes down there and he sees, oh shit, the Night King's presence has awoken these dragon skulls. Mm-hmm. They're starting to breathe fire.
Oh,
let's
shit.
Attach them and use them against his armies. But like, would they breathe fire? They'd breathe the blue.
It'd be the ice flame, whatever.
We don't know what that does to whites.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah, probably makes them, heals them.
Probably, yeah.
If you're a skeleton,
that's
you turn
guess.
Into a brawny lad mm-hmm. if you get breathed by dragon fire. But it'd be kind of sick to see those like launched in a trebuchet, just like the spinning death flame thing coming down on you. I'm back on the dragon skull resurrection theory.
Let me ask you this. What do you think happens to the human army when they get breathed on by the new white dragon?
That's a great...
Will they instantly turn... Anybody who's hit by that instantly turns to a white?
I wonder if they just freeze on the spot. Because like what... But the thing is, that's the other thing, is like, yeah, I mean, the dragon fire is blue.
I mean, the force of it alone would just blow them apart, right? Look what it did to the wall.
Yeah. But the thing is like, the wall was a magical construct. So, like, I'm trying to think how much of that, like, if he breathed that ice fire on a conventional ice wall, would have it just added a layer of ice to it, or is it actually physically hot? I don't think it can be, because like, it would be as much a danger to the White Walkers and the whites themselves. So
yeah,
these are all great questions. I can't wait to see. It's going to be like, if the dragons ever do battle, like some of my favorite moments in the Fire and Blood Targaryen history that George released last year was the like aerial dragon combat. It's savage. It's fucking savage, man. Like, dragons are ripping wings off each other and they're breathing fire. It's like,
God, I hope they're able to depict that.
Yeah, like these opposed forces of the ice flame and the fire flame. But the other thing about dragons too is like canonically their flames are all different colors too. Like Beleriand had black fire,
like lightsabers. It all comes back to Star Wars.
You're right. You need the Windurius who has a purple flame.
Can we just start calling the dragons Skywalkers?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, Lucas is done with the Skywalkers after his next movie, so why not?
Let's take it.
Let's see. Steve F., I've been rewatching the show since I wanted to keep my mind fresh for season 8. I was watching season 2 with Arya and Jack and Hagar, and it got me thinking, if Arya had substituted one of her names for Tywin Lannister, where would the show now be? Would Rob be alive? Would Joffrey be having a reign of terror? Without Tywin's marriage proposal for he and Margaery, would Tyrion be with Dany? I think the entire realm would be different, and there are so many little moments like this across the show that have made such huge changes.
Yeah, definitely something we've talked about.
It's because, like, the thing is, Rob, I think Rob lost the war the second he broke his marriage vow to Walder Frey.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if Lord Frey would be bold enough to openly defy and kill him without the protection, or Bolton without the protection from the Lannisters and the rewards, but like, for sure he's not going to give him his troops.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like already like Roose Bolton was kind of hedging his bets because he was making sure that forces loyal to Rob was taking more of their more than their fair share of licks in the battles and kind of keeping him and his men preserved in these things. So I just feel like that once he just made that just bad strategic and tactical error in setting aside his betrothal, that's like I don't think Rob could achieve a military victory from that point forward.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, you know, that's the other thing. Like, you know, what would Joffrey look like if no one, like if Tywin wasn't there to restrain him? I don't know.
Would have made Tyrion's life a hell of a lot easier.
Would it have?
He might not have ever got out of the Lannister family, but yeah, he wouldn't have had to kill him and go on the run and be a fugitive.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's true. That's true, because he wouldn't have killed him himself.
Right.
But he would have been fighting a political war against his sister with no, like, you know, say what you will.
But I think at that time he was smarter than his sister.
Well, he's definitely smarter, but like, who had more in actual influence? Like, you know,
over Joffrey, definitely Cersei. Even though hers was waning
over
too.
The powers of the government, I guess Tyrion too. Yeah, it's really hard to argue that killing Tywin wouldn't have been just a net good thing if you're looking at it from a Stark's perspective anyway.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on to West. Do you think we will see any more Children of the Forest? It's possible that there are still some that survived in the Isle of Faces where the Pact of the First Men took place. That's that God's Eye lake that we talked about a couple emails ago. It would be interesting to see them help defeat the Night King because in the World of Ice and Fire, they say this about the Long Night. Alone he, the last hero, reached finally the children, despite the efforts of the White Walkers, and all the tales agree that this was the turning point. Thanks to the children, the first men of the Night's Watch banded together and able to defeat and win the Battle for the Dawn. What do you think, Jim? Do you think they're still... What? Just as a show watcher, what's your impression of what the show is trying to tell us about the Children of the Forest? The last ones we saw, Leaf and her few companions that were with the Three-Eyed Crow in that cave.
I mean, honestly, it feels like they've made a huge mistake mm-hmm. that they now regret by unleashing the Night King upon the land of Westeros. And they're doing what they can to rectify that.
Did it feel like that was the last of the children? Or did it feel that, like, was there yes. anything that made stuck out? Okay, because yeah. that's where I was going. That I felt like the language the show was using was very much they're all that's left.
Yeah, like they're passing the torch to Bran and saying, you have to do this for us
right.
because we're out. We're at the end of our rope.
Yeah, and I don't think that they survived because of why wouldn't they follow Bran? Like, he's now the Three-Eyed Raven. He's the most important thing for them to protect. If
yeah.
any of them survived, why wouldn't they be here? So mm-hmm. now... In the books, I agree. Like, there's a lot more evidence to think that maybe in the Isle of Faces, where these trees are still remaining, and there's this order of the Green Men that kind of keep this island as a sacred place. And there's stories of, like, when people try to approach the island in a boat, like, strong winds blow them back, and, like, clouds of blackbirds, like...
You just gotta get Gendry out there.
Yeah.
He can row through those fucking winds, trust me.
He'll power right through it.
Yeah.
But until you get the...
Maybe that's his final purpose.
Until you get the forearms that were promised, or is it the...
It's the lats,
it's the
I
lats,
think, yeah.
the lats that
yeah.
were promised. the island was unreachable. So I think there's...
Fair.
And like, okay, like, maybe there's the... These green men have, like, enough magic that they can do that themselves. Maybe the children we know have elemental magic. Famously, they're responsible for the destruction of the land bridge that used to connect... Essos and Westeros. They also, by legend, are responsible for why the neck of the swampy area that connects the north and south of Westeros is flooded, because they tried to do the same thing again, only in a much weakened state. So I think in the show, no way. Because I think they have told show watchers that these are the last, just like the giants, there's last of the giants, you're not going to see any more. You might see some white versions of them, but you're not mm-hmm. going to see any fighting on the living side. Steve B., I was thinking of the two children who bailed on Missandei, and possibly even the small girl who will guard the crypts in episode 2 of season 8, could be spies sent by Qyburn. They fit the age range of the children he likes to use, their look, their demeanor. And I do remember Cersei mentioning that she has her spies up there in the north.
I like it.
I think that that's... Especially, I don't know about the two children who are just Mean Mug and Missandei. That seems like they do fit that description. I think the little girl that's going down in a crypt doesn't. She seems just more like a fierce northern, like a little mini... Well, I guess Leanna Mormont's kind of mini too.
Yeah.
A less highborn version of Leanne Mormont. But I, like I said, there's nothing to disprove that theory.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I guess the other thing is, like, I just don't feel like Qyburn could run Varys's fucking scheme right underneath Varys's nose, unless Varys too is
thinking,
dirty.
Yeah. Could Varys turn them?
And also there was some talk last season of Varys being a traitor inside. Like, that's the reason that Dany kept on suffering reversal after reversals, mm-hmm. is she had a spy in her midst. And I haven't heard that so much this season. Do you think that?
I mean, Varys hasn't been very prominent this season, so Right. Maybe the opportunity has just not come up to point at Varys and say, "Look, this fucker's dirty."
I don't know why, because the other thing is, like, I'll put my biases on the table. I've always thought that Varys is legit when he says that he tries to serve the realm.
I do too.
Not so much in the books, maybe, but I think in the show he's a much simpler mm-hmm. character, and he's kind of true blue. So, like, why would he, on the eve of this battle that's going to determine whether he himself lives or dies, why would he betray these, you know, kind of forces for good, the forces that are here to defend the realms of men that he claims to serve?
Mm-hmm.
But everybody can make that judgment for themselves, and we'll see. We only got a couple weeks left to see who wins and who loses here. Finally, Ben C. says, any thoughts on Theon and his Iron Islands common saying of what is dead may never die, but rises again harder and stronger, protecting Bran from the Night King and the army of the dead? I fucking love this theory, especially in combination with the Benjen stuff you're talking before.
What is the theory here?
So the Ironborn have a saying, what is dead may never die, but rises again harder and stronger. So the idea is that somehow Theon is going to die defending Bran, but experience a resurrection, and then as some kind of undead form of Theon, just tirelessly defend Bran. And I think that's a cool idea, because...
like a Benjen sort of thing?
Because,
like,
I could totally see Jon giving Bran an obsidian dagger and saying, look, if it comes to it, you can defend yourself to the utmost with this. And, like, Theon, like, being killed by a white or a white walker, and Bran, with all the knowledge that he has, knowing what his uncle Benjen told him about being resurrected, what if he plunges that dagger in Theon's chest
and potentially being able to see that moment?
Yeah. And then Theon then turns into some sucking fucking undead badass. And, like, because I was skeptical, like, oh yeah, Theon, yeah, you're really going to fucking defend Bran. But this is a pretty good mechanism for how he could do that.
I still think this is, you know, the final moment for Theon mm-hmm. to die defending Bran. But, yeah.
I mean, that would even be a little bit more of a tragic end if he's, like, not just dead, he's undead. Like, like Benjen never perpetrated, like, that was a fun existence to have.
No.
It seemed like kind of like you're in a damned state. But I like it. I think it would be a super cool visual, and it would give Theon a maximally heroic way to go out. Maybe he sets himself on fire at the end, anytime they want to sell you that a vampire's kind of gone good and he's wary of this life, and he just goes out into the sun and sets himself on fire because he's just so over it. Mm-hmm. Like, Theon does that with drops a torch at his feet, and like, I've served all my purpose. I've peaked. My character arc has come to an end. Whoosh.
Could be. We'll see.
And that is that's the spoiler cast for this week. If you would like to send us feedback, we're doing this all over again next week. You can do it at gameofthrones@baldmove.com. You can also discuss on the forums with our fellow fans at forums.baldmove.com. Don't forget that we will be back tomorrow if you're listening to this on Thursday. Or no, sorry. I forgot our own production schedule. Don't forget that we've got a Avengers Endgame review. I think a lot of you are probably watching that movie this weekend. If you want to hear our thoughts and discuss it with us, it'll be out there in the Bald Movies feed. Don't forget that we also released a new Super Serious Fan Fest to celebrate Game of Thrones. This week was Army of Darkness.
I don't think you've ever said the name of that right. Ever. Not once.
What? Super Serious Film Fest Fantasy?
There you go.
What I say that time? Super Fist Face Fuck Far?
Something that was closer to what you said, yeah.
Clown Penis Dot Fart? we'll have that, yeah. It's Army of Darkness. It's pretty... Yeah. It's unconventional fantasy choice.
For sure, but it has, you know, armies of undead.
Armies of undead, which I think
qualifies it for sort
castles,
of a Game of Thrones
swords,
tie-in. Right?
Shotguns, chainsaws.
Mm-hmm.
What if you had a dragonglass chainsaw?
Game over.
Holy shit. If you had Ash with the dragon glass, like, he's Azor Ahai right there. Everybody gives it up.
Shooting, you know, but like birdshot, except it's It's just Dragonglass.
He steals
little pellets.
He steals John's girl. Mm-hmm. He steals the Lord of Light's girl. He's got Danny and Melisandre both. Like, he's unstoppable. That's in our Bald Movies feed too. Have a great weekend. We'll see you Sunday night for the Instant Talk and Instant Take Instant Talk podcast for club members. And until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.